This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio, 98.3 and 102.1.
Hi, this is Dr. Bob Fetrakis bringing you The Other Side of the News. Got three educators, artists, and liberators in the studio. And we're going to start with India Jackson and ask India, what are you up to? What is going on? You're out there organizing. What are you trying to accomplish?
So I am not just an organizer. I'm also a graduate teaching assistant at Ohio State University and a writing consultant. And so in my capacity...
What's your specialty?
So I'm in the Department of English, but my specialty area is African-American literature post-1945, particularly African-American literature of the Black Liberation Era.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my capacity as a teacher at Ohio State University, I try to get students to think about literature through the lens of police and criminality and think about the way that different people have had to be marginalized in order for us to get to where we are as a nation today. And so I guess you could say that a kind of mission in all of this is, generally speaking, to get us toward a state of Black liberation.
Okay. A book me and my co-author, senior editor of the Free Press, Harvey Wasserman, just wrote argued that the, and I'm sure you're familiar with this argument, that the war on drugs was in fact a deliberate racist repression of the Black Power movement. How do you see that analysis?
I think that's absolutely spot on. We recently had, late last year, a letter from Richard Nixon's assistant,
Ehrlichman.
Exactly, Ehrlichman, who came out and said that the purpose of the war on drugs was to suppress hippies and to suppress the Black Power movement. And so I think that's, you know, right on.
Okay, so yeah, he, I think it was it was Atlantic or Harper, but it was an old interview.
Yes.
And he came out and said the entire war on drugs was absolutely bogus. It was the suppressed Black Power movement and the white peace movement, the hippies and yippies.
And I think we can just, like, look at the after results, and I think, I mean, connecting the dots, like, that's what has happened.
Like the largest police state in all of modern history?
Yeah.
That is disproportionately locking up Blacks and people of color and, of course, poor people.
Right here in the land of the free.
All right. So as you put all this together... what are you organizing and to what end?
So right now my primary activity is in an organization called AGOBO. That's a group of Black organizers. So we're a group of organizers who are Black, and our primary goal is to not only seek Black liberation, but in order to kind of lead the strategy for Black anti-racist work in the city of Columbus. And so we are mostly people ages 18 to 40 who are interested in uplifting our communities, but doing so in a way that our voices are the ones that are being brought to the forefront, and our voices are the ones that are leading our causes, our initiatives, and echoing the demands of the community as well.
What would Black liberation look like in Columbus? I don't see, as there was, you know, maybe a century ago, major Black banking moneyed institutions. I see the complete disbursement by the city, you know, which has Black council members of the Black population in Poindexter. I see white police, plainclothes and undercover, terrorizing Black communities. And when people protest, they're told, we'll look into it. And then basically, from my perspective, they quadruple it. They say, okay, that summer safety initiative, that shooting Black people down in the back, we're going to go year round with it. What is your goal? What are we fighting here? And what would it look like to actually have a liberated Columbus?
So The goal is a lofty, long one that is not, you know, likely going to be completed during my time here. But I say it's a goal that's threefold. That is to liberate us from economic, political, and social oppression. So in short, that means to end the state as it is.
Okay, end the state and reconstruct it in a different manner?
That's what revolution is, yeah.
Okay. Michaela. Michaela Mason, you're out there organizing. What are you working on?
I'm also a member of Agobo, as well as I am in an art collective known as Dank, which is a collective for black children and also like adults as well. And I organized the Melancholy Music Festival, which was a festival to shine light on artists of color in Columbus.
And why is it important to shine light on artists of color? And again, if this was the 50s, you'd be under surveillance as a subversive for promoting black separatists or even black artists, right? We were all supposed to be Americans, and it would be American art, not black art.
Right. So to me, when I first moved to Columbus, I really... was drawn to the music scene, but I noticed that there's I would go to a venue and I'd be the only black person there. There weren't a lot of representation for black bands, you know, Hispanic bands, really outside of the hip hop scene. So the goal with Melancholy was to be able to say, hey, we are in Columbus, we exist, and we're out here making music as well. Basically pay attention to us, give us a space to celebrate our art as well.
Does your group do any of the analysis? I've heard many of the black organizations over in the King Lincoln area saying this area used to have 36 live clubs, you know, all black artists, and they cut off with the expressway, right? Walled it off,
yeah.
And essentially starved it of live culture. Do you accept that analysis?
Of course, yeah. That's definitely... city planning of segregation.
Every major
from
city.
Wall it off, keep the white people out
of
black neighborhoods and being exposed to black music, which of course brought us the Rolling Stones and the Beatles.
Yeah.
For the long run. So how's it going? Are there a lot of artists out there? How do you bring them together?
Wow. We receive. I want to say we had close to 100 acts over 3 days. It just happened last weekend. And every applicant was, we accepted every applicant to come perform because it was, our duty to kind of create this space and to not turn anyone away. It had a really good outcome. I've heard a lot of, really positive feedback from people. People said, it was really inspiring for them. Really, we got a lot of feedback. We had, these little cards of, why Melancholy was important to you. And I remember, one little black girl, in particular, she wrote one in, pink marker that was, because black girls can make music, too. And she was, really young. And I have that hanging up, on my refrigerator because that was, really important to me.
Do you buy into the analysis that white corporate America deliberately destroyed political hip-hop and tried to commercialize it into forms of stereotypes, and that a lot of the early stuff that came out of the South Bronx is that actually was seen as an enemy of the white state?
That is a loaded question.
Well, I'm thinking about, Afrika Bambaataa and the whole, even the kind of public enemy sort of situation.
I would say so. I know a lot of white kids love to listen to rap music, but I don't think they listen to it for the words.
But it's straight out of Upper Arlington. Come a brother named Tyler.
Right, right.
And he's wearing No Fear or streetwear, which no real, real streetwise guy would do, would advertise that he wasn't afraid.
Is it okay if I jump
sure.
in? So I use music a lot to teach. You know, my course is about police and criminality. And what really strikes me is the way that students often don't understand the way that hip-hop was initially used as a tool of political kind of communication within the Black community. And so I, you know, even give the music from N.W.A., from Tupac Shakur, you know, who were at the height of gangster rap music. They don't understand that while their message, you know, was one that definitely is in some ways violent, that the violence that these people are portraying is coming from a place of abjection, right? And so there's definitely a political message in that. And so we've gotten to a point where that political message has been completely lost. You know, Tupac's, you know, earliest albums were not his most popular albums, right? So he had to do some things that are different, you know, hit him up instead to become a more popular artist. And that's really where things have gone since, I guess you could say, the Bling era began in the late 1990s.
And KRS-One not getting as much attention as many of us would have hoped for.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. What else, Michaela, should we know about the music scene for Blacks and people of color? But you're right, it seems most of it college town, centered around the campus area, overwhelmingly, you know, white bands, white venues. How can we change that?
I think by, you know, even going out of your way to reach out to artists of color, like, they're out there and they're, like, really good, because I think we have to work a lot harder to be accepted than most, like, white people and the artists on all, like, spectrums of art. We have, like, a higher standard that we have to reach to, so, like, our art that we are putting out, like, is really, really good. And I think that if people would just go out of their way to open their doors to allowing them to actually come in and, you know, have that time to really, like, display, like, what they're working on, that within itself would be, like, a huge, like, accomplishment and a huge thing to do.
How diverse is the Black music scene?
Very.
Many of us lamented, you know, like, what happened to Marvin Gaye and what's going on, which was, in fact, very political album, and that sort of, you know, incredible soul seemed to have been destroyed by white-owned corporations who distributed the music. But you're saying there's a lot of variation out there?
Yeah. At first, when I first was introduced to, like, artists of color, they were all, like, they made hip-hop.
Right.
And as, like, this was, like, our second Melancholy. The first one was kind of, like, a zero run to just kind of get a feel for things.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, even just with that, it was one day, a couple hours, and we had so many, like, different genres, like, come through, and I was like, wow, like, they're out there. Like, not everyone is doing hip-hop. Just because you're Black doesn't mean you have to be a hip-hop artist. And I think that's also something that's really important to keep in mind as well.
And the hip-hop is pretty diverse,
yeah,
too.
And the hip-hop is very diverse. Yeah, it's tough, yeah.
Okay. Torin, you're an educator. Torin Jacobs, you've been on the show before. What are you working on?
Hey, Bob. It's good to be back once mm-hmm. again. So, first and foremost, you know, working with my kids at teach high school at a dropout school. We just had our graduation today, and it was very exciting to see all the kids who we struggled with for the whole year. You know, very excited to finally be walking across the stage. It's like you see a side of them that you don't see too often, you know, just crying and doing that kind of stuff. So that was great. But besides teaching and doing that kind of stuff, I also doing Columbus Citizens for Police Review. So a group that we started a few years ago, that I started a few years ago, to have an independent review board over the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, there was a lot of barriers to that, and there still are. And it's now more apparent than ever that we do need independent oversight over the police. But of course, we have a city council and political leadership that is just completely deaf to that idea and the needs of the people.
Why do you say now more than ever?
Well, because we just, after we had Henry Green, so when I started this initiative back in 2015, this is before we had Henry Green,
mm-hmm.
this is before we had Tyree King, and before then we did have
Henry King in the Linden area walking down the street in an open carry state with a gun, and of course the Summer Safety Initiative, plainclothes police in unmarked vehicles jump out and essentially shoot him repeatedly.
Exactly. And I have students who knew him personally, who knew Henry personally, and
mm-hmm.
knew his mother. and they called him by his nickname and not Henry. But yeah, you know, this is a real person who was a good kid, no record, had a legal firearm and was gunned down by the police. The Jump Out Boys is what they're known as. Mm-hmm. And they jumped out on him and they executed him and brought, I don't know if it was daylight, but, you know, executed him in front of his neighborhood, in front of his home. So, but even before that, you know, we had Obie Shepherd, and we had a whole list of cases where the Columbus police were out of line and
Edgar Hayes, people. Who was shot in the back. You're listening to WGRN 94.1, your community radio. Yeah, you had Dante Miller, you had Edgar Hayes with two eyewitnesses saying that he was running full speed away and shot in the back. The police claimed he had a gun and he hit the ground and it bounced 100 feet. And again, this was the Jump Out Boys. At that time, they were pretending like they were drug addicts and would put money all over them and have their guns drawn waiting to shoot somebody. So, what are you doing about it?
Yeah, so let me go back to that one point you said before about, you know, why now more than ever. So we've had the murders before, but now, like I said, we have two high-profile killings by Columbus police. And
the second one being Tyree?
Tyree King, yeah. But it's much harder for them to hide their dirt, which is what they were so good at doing before, because the same officer who was involved in Henry Green's shooting was now caught on tape kicking another suspect in the face. And
Officer Mason has shot four people, two lived. And the story, it's, I mean, I'm not buying a 13-year-old kid who's got a BB gun, stops and points. I mean, just not that stupid, right? It's like, I got a BB gun that won't do anything to you. Let me give you an excuse. You know, I think what the coroner's report said, right? He was running away and he was shot in the back. How can they get away with these stories that are so absurd?
Well, it's not just the Columbus problem, it's a nationwide problem. There's just so many, the way the system is set up, it's just almost impossible to actually prosecute people. These police officers who do commit murder.
They can say, I was fearful like Zach Rosen. I was fearful for my life.
Yeah, that's immunity.
When he of course kicked him in the head.
They know the magic words.
Yeah, and that's their little immunity clause, and I don't know how we can get around that to change that system. Like I said, there's so much money and power behind that.
Well, there's a powerful political endorsement, right? The FOP, Fraternal Order of Police, and also you've got a one-party system, right? You've got one party, no real opposition. And I speak as somebody, I ran for prosecutor and got 32,000 votes on a Black Lives Matter ticket. But the two people who ran against me both spent over $1 million, and neither of them wanted a civilian review board, which to me makes perfect sense. Why do the police get to investigate the police?
Why do they?
Go ahead.
Because no one gets held accountable doing that. You know, it's just like anytime you investigate yourself, you're going to throw out all the things.
Man, I'm not guilty again.
it's just human nature. It's common sense to not want to punish yourself. You know, so that's why you need to have outside body, outside oversight to do this kind of things. And even, you know, we need to, even as being an educator, I have self-evaluations, but I'm also required to be evaluated by your supervisors, by the principal, and all this kind of, even the state,
even
right?
The state, your peers, your superiors, you know, the authorities over you. It seems like there's many layers of accountability that teachers have, but the police get essentially evaluated by other police, and then they rotate them. Mm-hmm. It's not like they got this little isolated group of highly professional police that are coming after you. But these police, right, I mean, they have to go back out on the street after they've been in Internal Affairs Bureau.
And where's Rosen now? Is he still on desk? Is he on desk duty? Or?
I think he's still on desk duty.
Yeah.
Collecting those checks.
Yeah.
So, like you said, it's just unbelievable how incompetent and stupid you can be, and how, but you still can keep your job. I mean, like I said, as an educator, if you had someone doing all this stuff, you get fired, you get thrown in jail. At least, what happened down in Georgia with the fraudulent test scores and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, same with the police. Like I said, you know, they have permission, they have a license to kill. It's like a Bond movie.
And it seems like really it's a handful of these people. Like Mason shot four people. Why isn't there a one and done? Like, you kill one person, why should you ever be on the street with a gun again? you know, you should be, you know, pushing paper or finding another job.
And I think this also just speaks to the incompetence of our chief, who needs to be fired. She really has no no business being the figurehead of the Columbus Police Department.
But again, India seized the time. I mean, wasn't this the same problem that the Black Panthers evolved out of? Massive police brutality?
Absolutely. It's the same problem that they, you know, were combating. It's the same problem that our civil rights icons were combating. It's the same problem that the Scottsboro Boys were combating. We can keep going farther and farther back, you know, until like the beginning of our time here. It's the same story. We know where the police came from in America, right? They started off as exactly slave catchers. It's the same. It's the same system.
So the system itself has evolved historically, but at its core, it's still slave catchers and people suppressing the black community.
Absolutely.
I mean, during slavery, we had a system whereby you could kill an enslaved person because they were not seen as a person. And the only penalties that were paid is if somebody, you know, destroyed your property, right? Yeah. But otherwise, the system policed itself. The system said that these were not people, and so they were not treated as people, so there was no crime committed. Now we have a system where we have police who are investigating themselves, so they're controlling the system, so they can say whether or not a crime has been committed. And so we still see that black life has no value. It's still no crime that's been committed.
Okay, I'm speaking with Michaela Mason, India Jackson, Torin Jacobs. All out organizing to shift the balance of power in this community away from the status quo, away from the police, away from that one-party system, and to foster black liberation. So, Michaela, in the music, is there any reflection? Briefly, we spoke as a group about the question of black liberation through music, it's diversity. What's happening out there?
I mean, it's seen in a lot of different, like various platforms of music. I think the most popular one would be Beyonce at the moment with Lemonade. Her song Formation was, the video itself, you know, shown, it said on the brick wall, like, stop shooting us. She was syncing with the police vehicle. Yeah, like it's, people are talking about it, like definitely in their
Kendrick,
music.
Kendrick, Solange.
Kendrick Lamar, Solange, yeah.
Childish Gambino, everybody.
Have you been seeing any of this locally? Reflected anything that's going out there in Columbus itself?
Yes. A lot of our musicians talk about it thoroughly. I know quite a few, I can't think of the names off the top of my head, but it was brought up a lot during Mountain Collie. Remember the first Mountain Collie, we had a performer come from New York, Soul Patches, and they did a final performance at the end. The song was about police brutality, and they did like the hands up, like don't shoot kind of thing, and that was really powerful.
India, Cleaver or Huey Newton, which one was more correct?
Oh, that's a difficult question.
I only ask because I originally, as a white supporter of the Black Panthers, I was in a group called the White Panthers. I think mainly we smoked pot, and they used to call us the props. We'd show up and raise our fist in solidarity. But I always thought Eldridge Cleaver, this great worldview. And then in retrospect, I've always thought, I mean, Huey Newton, develop the community, you know, feed the community, organize the community, is that, you know, this whole notion of worldwide revolution wasn't really happening, but the community is still being fed, and a lot of that's been institutionalized. So when you look, you're out there organizing yourself, how do you see your relationship to, I mean, you're in some cases more formally educated than the people you're organizing. How do you reach a community that is clearly and obviously repressed by the police and social economic conditions?
Well, certainly I've, you know, been privileged to have certain experiences in my life, but I must say I'm not a Columbus native. I came here from Alabama. All right. So my parents, my mother, she is from Childersburg, Alabama, and my father is an immigrant, you know, so on that side, I'm a second generation American. And so I, you know, don't feel as if I'm that far removed from my community. I did go to historically black college, Tuskegee University, for my undergraduate degree. And so I don't know, I feel at home when I'm in the community. I don't know if people would challenge that, but I do feel as if I am building with my people, my family, people who I care about, the reason why I do the things that I do, the reason why I'm pursuing higher education. It doesn't feel like a pursuit that's just for me. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think that I was going to be able to give anything back.
Again, the questions of the pedagogy of the oppressed and, you know, the wretched of the earth, do you bring any sort of epistemological approaches to liberating people? Are there any philosophies or educational perspectives that you're working off of? I mean, how do you liberate people in an era of essentially Facebook?
So I would definitely describe myself as an Afro-pessimist. And so I think that the thing that really helps me is to like have a really, I guess, strong understanding of history, but also that for me is powerful because I get to understand what has happened here, and I don't think that everybody quite understands what has happened here in this country. And so more than anything, what I'm trying to do is get people to understand what has been done here, what exactly has happened. And for some people, that is really a kind of depressing, tragic ordeal, and rightfully so, but I don't think that we can really begin to think about revolution and the way that it needs to happen until we're able to understand first what has been done here. And we can see the history repeating itself.
Like, even with revolutions, why past revolutions have failed. That's really something important to...
And why have they failed?
I knew you were going to answer this better than I am.
Why revolutions?
Yeah, go ahead. Why have revolutions failed? Other than the other side has
more power.
Most of the guns.
Yeah.
I think the other side has most of the guns. I think that you also find, you know, masses of people who are not necessarily complacent, but they have, they feel that they have too many things to lose, too many things
particularly
to
in Columbus,
worry about.
I'm from Detroit originally. This city seems to have a very tolerant black community.
So, yes. So this is one of my, I guess, favorite anecdotes about Columbus. So in 1968, we had the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., April 4th. And so shortly after, in the following days, there was major uprisings in most major cities around the country. And so there's two major cities where there was no major uprising. One of those cities was Boston, Massachusetts, and if you want to know why, I can give you an article that I wrote about that. Okay. But the other major city where there was no major uprising was Columbus, Ohio. And the reason why I believe that didn't happen is because there was no strong branch of the Black Panther Party, no strong, I guess, civil rights movement going on at that period, since we had had the Civil Rights Act passed and the Voting Rights Act passed. You now had a community of black middle class who felt somewhat complacent, who felt that they had in some ways made it. And so we did not have the community organizers necessary to push us forward. And so we still see that complacency in Columbus today. We have a very conservative church-going community, which is, you know, fine. But at a certain point, things have to give. And I think that what's going to get us there is that we have to, one, understand what has happened to us. The internet is making that possible for us to understand what has happened to us. And I think that people have to feel that they don't have any thing to fight for anymore. Well, or I guess, no, not anything to lose, but they don't have any other option.
All right. India Jackson with the last word. Michaela, thanks a lot for being on the show. Torin, we're going to have you back on and talk in detail about the Civilian Review Board.
Absolutely.
Interesting discussion, India. We're going to have both of you back, probably individually and as a tandem. I got to wrap up, though. Thanks.